Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 18, Text 16.
Sa-va-vai.
Translation. O Suta Goswami, please describe those topics of the Lord by which Maharaj Parikshit, whose intelligence was fixed on liberation, attained the lotus feet of the Lord, who was the shelter of Garuda, the king of birds. Those topics were vibrated by the son of Vyasa, Srila Shukadeva. Please repeat. O Suta Goswami, please describe those topics of the Lord.
Please describe those topics of the Lord.
By which Maharaj Parikshit,
whose intelligence was fixed on liberation,
attained the lotus feet of the Lord.
Who is the shelter of Garuda,
the king of birds.
Those topics were vibrated by the son of Vyasa.
Srila Shukadeva. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. There is some controversy amongst the students on the path of liberation. Such transcendental students are known as impersonalists and devotees of the Lord. The devotee of the Lord worships the transcendental form of the Lord, whereas the impersonalist meditates upon the glaring effulgence or the bodily rays of the Lord, known as the Brahma Jyoti. Here in this verse it is said that Maharaj Parikshit attained the lotus feet of the Lord by instructions in knowledge delivered by the son of Vyasadeva, Srila Shukadeva Goswami. Shukadeva Goswami was also an impersonalist in the beginning, as he himself has admitted in the Bhagavatam 2.1.9. But later on he was attracted by the transcendental pastimes of the Lord and thus became a devotee. Such devotees with perfect knowledge are called Mahabhagavatas, or first-class devotees. There are three classes of devotees, namely the Prakrita, Madhyama, and Mahabhagavata. The Prakrita, or third-class devotees, are temple worshippers without specific knowledge of the Lord and the Lord's devotees. The Madhyama, or second-class devotee, knows well the Lord, the Lord's devotees, the neophytes, and the non-devotees also. But the Mahabhagavata, or the first-class devotee, sees everything in relation with the Lord, and the Lord present in everyone's relation. The Mahabhagavata, therefore, does not make any distinction, particularly between a devotee and non-devotee. Maharaj Parikshit was such a Mahabhagavata devotee, because he was initiated by a Mahabhagavata devotee, Shukadeva Goswami. He was equally kind even to the personality of Kali and what to speak of others. So there are many instances in the transcendental histories of the world of an impersonalist who has later become a devotee. But a devotee has never become an impersonalist. This very fact proves that on the transcendental steps, the step occupied by a devotee is higher than the step occupied by an impersonalist. It is also stated in the Bhagavad Gita 12.5 that persons stuck on the impersonal step undergo more sufferings than achievement of reality. Therefore, knowledge imparted by Shukadeva Goswami unto Maharaj Parikshit helped him attain the service of the Lord. And this stage of perfection is called apavarga, or the perfect stage of liberation. Simple knowledge of liberation is material knowledge. Actual freedom from material bondage is called liberation. But attainment of the transcendental service of the Lord is called the perfect stage of liberation. Such a stage is attained by knowledge and renunciation, as we have already explained, Bhagavatam 1.2.12. And perfect knowledge is delivered by Shukadeva Goswami results in the attainment of the transcendental service of the Lord. Omanyana tamarandasya jananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manovistam stapitam yena bhutale svayam rupakadamayam dadati svapadantikam. This is the translation. O Suta Goswami, please describe those topics of the Lord by which Maharaj Parikshit, whose intelligence was fixed on liberation, attained the lotus feet of the Lord, who is the shelter of Garuda, the king of birds. Those topics were vibrated by the son of Vyasa, Srila Shukadeva. So, Prabhupada has given some description of different classes of devotees and the nature of the liberated state of existence. So, it's described that there are spirit souls. Jiva souls are in two different basic conditions of life. There are those who are absorbed in the material energy. Their consciousness is oriented towards enjoying material nature. And there are those who are aiming to become free from material bondage. Those are two basic categories of consciousness of the jiva souls. So becoming free from material bondage is liberation, or moksha, which Srila Prabhupada is referring to here. So at one level, there's merely the idea of liberation. On an intellectual level, one can consider the basic idea of the soul as something distinct from the material energy. And one can imagine some condition in which the soul could become free from entanglement in the material energy. So that's liberation on the conceptual platform. However, a person who understands certain ideas about liberation is not necessarily liberated. He merely has some ideas. So this can apply both to impersonalists and to devotees. One can simply have the idea of liberation. Actually, the idea has to come before the practical realization. So Srila Prabhupada also distinguishes here between the impersonalists and personalists. So there's the question of what the state of liberation really consists of. So one conception is that the liberated state must be, in some sense, the opposite of the materially conditioned state. One sees that in the materially conditioned state, there are variegated forms and activities and so forth. One sees that there is personal existence. There are people walking around with bodily shapes, and they have names and egos and so forth. So one sees that that is going on in the material world. So one can then imagine that, well, a liberated state would be one in which one gets away from this material condition. So that would mean entering into a state of consciousness which is the opposite somehow of the material condition, which would mean that there would be no variegatedness. You wouldn't have people with bodily shapes and so forth. You wouldn't have names, forms, and so on. So this is the idea of negation of material aspects of reality. In an attempt to come up with some sort of conception of what a liberated state would be like. So there's even a technical name for that. It's called neti neti, which means not this and not that. This is a very common process of thinking. For example, in medieval Christian tradition, the same thing was there, and they called it via negativa, which is the same thing as neti neti. So that's one idea. Then there's the idea that there's something called the Brahma Jyoti, which one hears about, kind of effulgence or light, which is somehow beyond the material existence. So by combining these two lines of thought, the idea that there's this thing called the Brahma Jyoti, plus the idea of negating variegated form, you come up with the concept that liberation means to leave the state of variegated form and enter into a uniform condition of oneness, which is somehow associated with light, with this Brahma Jyoti. So that's the conception of impersonal liberation. So there's a lot one could say about this. This concept is very popular. One thing about it is that it's compatible with practically any other concept that you may have. You can always suppose that beyond the world as you conceive of it, there could be this state of undifferentiated light that you could somehow enter into. One can imagine this. This state of light does not provide any direct evidence of its existence within the material world. Actually, those who delve into the impersonal philosophy would argue that it couldn't do so, because any evidence that it gave of its existence would have to be variegated evidence. That is, it would have to have form. And as such, that would simply be material, and it wouldn't actually be this impersonal reality that one speaks of. Looking at it in a more sophisticated way, you can see that this impersonal reality couldn't be actually light after all, because light, after all, is a variegated material phenomenon, which is the opposite of dark. So you have duality there. So this Brahma Jyoti really couldn't be Jyoti. And so you couldn't expect it to give any evidence of itself. So therefore, in particular, this impersonal conception is completely compatible with, say, modern scientific ideas, simply because it's compatible with any ideas whatsoever. So it's compatible with scientific ideas in particular. So this idea of impersonal liberation is very popular, and it's intellectually respectable. You will find many people at universities, for example, who accept some form of impersonal philosophy. Very often they acquire this from some society promoting Advaita Vedanta, and so on and so forth. And you can also see that this impersonal concept is pervasive in practically all different forms of religion. I have just been looking into some descriptions of, in the Catholic tradition, of appearances of the Virgin Mary. It was very interesting. I won't go into the story, because actually in this class I'm supposed to tell you about something else. So I'm getting to that subject as fast as I can, but there are different topics that come up here. So anyway, this was interesting. There was an event in which some young children had this vision of the Virgin Mary. Anyway, at a certain point, to make a long story short, she opened up her hands over the children, and beams of light came out from her hands and bathed the children in this light. And the children realized that this light was full of God. That was the phrase that was used. And they went into some sort of state of ecstasy. So there you have the Brahman idea, Brahma Jyoti, to be specific, a light that conveys some realization of God. So it was interesting to note that that was the only, explicit form in which God entered into that whole story, which I'm not going into, of this visitation of the Virgin Mary. God appeared there as light. So even in Christianity, in areas of Christian mysticism and so forth, it's the same thing. You have this Brahma-Jyoti idea. So anyway, going one step further, the basic philosophy of Krishna consciousness is that the Supreme Absolute Truth is a person. And furthermore, there's a hierarchy of forms going from material form as we experience it on up to transcendental form. So the basic idea there is that from the original absolute form, which would be Krishna, different other forms are expanded. This, of course, is a very complex story also. There are the expansions of Vishnu Tattva, Shakti Tattva, and so forth. On the transcendental level, there are many categories of expansions of Vishnu. So there's a variegated spiritual world. There's Goloka Vrindavan and Vaikuntha. All kinds of activities are going on there. These spiritual realms are characterized by form and variety, but at the same time, the form there is not material. The forms of Vishnu are eternal. In fact, time does not exist in the spiritual world in the sense that we think of it. Past, present, and future are not there in the spiritual world, but at the same time, there are pastimes. So how can there be pastimes if there's no passage of time? But there's a different kind of time, a kind of time in which you have things happening, but nothing passes away. There's a nice description of that in the Brahma Samhita. So, in addition to the spiritual world, there's the material world. So, in the material world, there are also manifestations of form, but here you have a new element, namely time, which has the property of creation and destruction. Time has the three phases of past, present, and future. So the future is always coming into the present through the process of creation. And whatever there is at present is always going into the past through the process of destruction. So the principles of creation and destruction give you past, present, and future. So they're characterized by the three modes of nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. In the spiritual world, you have goodness, purified goodness, or Vishuddha Sattva. And in the material world, there is also goodness, but there are two additional elements which are not present in the spiritual world, namely this passion, which corresponds to creation, and ignorance, which corresponds to annihilation or destruction. So that's the situation then in the material world. In the material world, everything is changing. It's coming into being and going out of being continuously. Sometimes this is happening in a gradual and peaceful way, as happens as you gradually get older day by day. And then on other occasions, it occurs in a more abrupt and violent fashion. For example, an atomic bomb could go off and wipe people out, or something like that. But either way, you have this process of creation and destruction. So the Bhagavatam is explaining this whole situation of both the material world and the spiritual world. The basic aim of the Bhagavatam is to explain the relationship between what we actually see, which is material, given that we're conditioned souls, and the transcendental reality of Krishna. In order to be devotees of Krishna, you have to understand what Krishna is, what his position is. To understand that, you have to understand Krishna in relation with what we see and experience. It's one thing if you imagine the Absolute to be something totally inconceivable and beyond all concepts that can be formed. But in the case of Krishna consciousness, that is not the situation. As far as Krishna consciousness is concerned, there's actually a continuum between the world as we know it and the spiritual world. Of course, there's the old Christian statement that man is created in the image of God. And in Krishna consciousness, we have the same idea, actually. This human form is ultimately existing because Krishna has this form. This is an imitation of Krishna's form, made out of clay. Just as you can make a mannequin that you put in a store window, which is an imitation of the human form. It's not a perfect imitation. The mannequin is more limited than this human form that we have, because for one thing, all it can do is stand there, and it's actually hollow, made of little plastic tubes. But basically, it's an imitation of the human form. So similarly, this body, these human bodies that we have, are not like Krishna's body. They're not Satchitananda. They're made of perishable substances, molded temporarily. But it's an imitation of Krishna's form. And this imitation is there. Well, there are a number of aspects to it. I better not get into all of that. Moving on towards the point that I'm supposed to talk about. As I was saying, the important point about the Bhagavatam is that it's explaining the relationship between these forms we see in this world and the transcendental forms in the spiritual world. Now that brings you to the point that it's somewhat hard for people in modern society to understand the descriptions given in the Bhagavatam, because there's a competing worldview which is very prominent in modern society, which is being provided by science. So nowadays, science is explaining to us the nature of the world. Science is confronting this world of variegated form and categorizing everything, classifying it, and explaining what it is, how it works, and where it came from. So this is the traditional role of religion. In particular, this is the role that is played by the Srimad Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam is explaining what the world is, how it works, where it comes from. However, the way the Bhagavatam explains it opens up the door of liberation for human beings, because in particular, the world has a doorway, so to speak, that opens up to the spiritual world. The world is so constructed that it is possible to go from the material state of consciousness to a purely spiritual state of consciousness. Liberation is actually possible. The spirit soul can become free from this material state of existence and go to Vaikuntha or Goloka Vrindavan. So the Bhagavatam is explaining the world in that way so as to open the door of liberation for the conditioned souls. So modern science also has an explanation of the world. But in the scientific explanation of the world, there's no such thing as a doorway to liberation. That doesn't exist. It doesn't even enter into the conceptual picture that modern science is providing. Modern science is giving a total description of reality based on matter. I could go into detail on that, actually. Just yesterday, I was talking with one devotee about this Stephen Hawking, who's a somewhat famous scientist. Well, Stephen Hawking has been trying to add the finishing touches to the Big Bang Theory. So what are those touches? Well, the trouble with the Big Bang Theory is that it has a singularity at the beginning. This is a point where all the laws of space and time break down. And unfortunately, it occurs right at the beginning of the whole thing. In other words, if you go backwards in time, looking at the Big Bang Theory, the universe should be shrinking, because they say the universe is expanding. So if you imagine going back in time, the universe is shrinking, getting smaller and smaller. But everything is occurring according to the laws of physics, as you go back further and further, until you get right to the very beginning. At that point, everything breaks down because everything shrinks to a literal point. There's no volume, there's no distinction between particles, there's no space. everything totally collapses. So it's a bit of a problem if at the very beginning you've broken down. It's like you're going to start on a journey in your automobile, but the automobile is broken down before you start. You're told that 10 seconds after you start, the car will work just fine. In fact, 1 second after you start, it will work just fine. The only trouble is that at the moment you start, it's broken. So you can't get anywhere. So the Big Bang Theory is like that. It can't get started. So that's a bit of a flaw. And Stephen Hawking has been trying to repair the theory. And so he came up with a way of doing it, in which as you go back in time towards the beginning of the Big Bang, time sort of swerves around mathematically, and you wind up going forward in time again. You can't get back to the beginning the way he has it set up. So that eliminates the problem. The beginning is sort of snipped out. So he does it in a tricky mathematical way. He says, going back to the beginning of the Big Bang is like talking about going north of the North Pole. You know, if you keep going north and you just keep on going, you'll wind up going south again, because you just go over the North Pole and you're going south on the other side. So he has it set up like that. So one point he made was that if we allow the Big Bang to have a beginning, then you must ask, well, what's on the other side of the beginning? And he said, by definition, that's God. And he didn't like that idea at all. So his aim was to eliminate God. Basically, that's the aim in modern science. And scientists have been very successful in doing that. They've created a very convincing picture. Now, one thing they've done to make this convincing picture is they have shown that all these old religious scriptures are wrong in all kinds of different ways. The idea is that wherever the religious scripture tells you about something you can actually see or measure, it's wrong. And we can show that. So then, if that's true, why should you believe the religious scripture when it tells you about something totally beyond your senses, something completely transcendental? Every time the religious scripture tells you about something you can see, the scripture's wrong. So should we believe that it's right about things you can't see? So that's the basic position presented by modern science. That's how science has eliminated religion. It's a very convincing argument. People buy it all over the world. They buy it in India also, in all the universities and so forth. And you'll hear people in India saying, we've had enough of religion in this country. This is what has held us back. Look at all this poverty. You know, if only we could get rid of religion and have science, then the problems would be solved. So this is the viewpoint that people have accepted. So it's quite a convincing argument. It is, however, a false argument, because although science, as it exists today, can do a lot of things, there are what you might say some riders attached to the bills being passed in the scientific legislature, if I could make an analogy. You may know that in Congress, if you want to pass some legislation which isn't popular, then what you do is you write that legislation into another bill which you know is going to pass because it's very popular for some reason. Then, when that bill is passed, your unpopular legislation gets passed along with it. It's a standard trick that is used in Congress. So in science, a similar thing has been done. Everyone knows that certain things in science work. For example, radios work, computers work, automobiles, airplanes, and so forth. So scientists have been able to understand something about the world in a way that is practical and realistic. So what they do then is attach onto their exposition of all these things that work certain theories that actually don't work. But you accept the theory because of all the things that they've done which do work. Basically, that's what's going on in science. However, this isn't obvious. It's not a simple matter, because scientists have put their case together very effectively. And after all, they've been working at it now for about 300 years. And there are quite a large number of scientists who've been working on this for this entire period of time, especially within the 19th and 20th centuries. But if you look at the different theories that are prominent within modern science, you'll find all kinds of things that are not actually correct. There's the theory of evolution, for example. Now, the theory of evolution is the replacement for the creation theory, if we can call it that, which you'll find in the Bhagavatam. The scientists will say that life developed gradually from matter over a long period of time, and so forth. So in the Bhagavatam, there's a different description that is given. According to the Bhagavatam version, Vishnu first created the a very highly developed life form within the nascent universe. This was Brahma. And then from Brahma, other living beings were expanded, and gradually, in a series of descending expansions, different types of living entities were developed, until finally you wind up with the living beings on the earth, human beings, plants, animals, and so forth. So it's a series of expansions coming down from Brahma. So this is the Vedic description. So if you look at, just to take this theory of evolution as an example, the theory itself has many different defects, which you can understand by examining the theory, and that's a whole subject that I won't go into. But even if you point out these defects and you show that that theory is incorrect, then there's the question about showing positively that the theory of creation, if you like, presented in the Bhagavatam is correct. Well, you can show that there's a lot of empirical evidence that supports the picture given in the Bhagavatam. This evidence is not something that you will tend to learn about if you go to school and study science, because the scientists, in fact, cannot deal with this evidence. But nonetheless, there is a great deal of empirical evidence that supports the basic picture of creation given in the Bhagavatam. Just to very briefly mention one category of evidence, there's something broadly called psychic healing or mystical healing. There's a huge amount of empirical data on this. But basically, what it involves is the power of the mind, or at least somebody's mind, to repair the body. So there are all kinds of very striking examples in which, for example, a person was on the verge of death from some very severe disease, advanced cancer, or something like that. And suddenly they were completely cured. Their body was put back together again, basically. And how was this done? What was the agency? Well, if you look at the evidence, you'll see that basically there's a good case can be made that some subtle agency involving consciousness and intelligence was responsible for reconstructing or repairing the ailing gross physical body. So if this kind of thing is possible, and you can make a case for this, I'm not going to try and go into that here, but there's all kinds of evidence that you can present. So if this kind of thing is possible, then it is likewise possible that the bodies could have been built in the first place by some subtle agency. And that, in fact, is precisely what the Bhagavatam is telling us, that the gross bodies were produced from more subtle types of bodies. Actually, the present human gross bodily forms are descended from the forms of demigods. That's the description given in the Bhagavatam. These demigods came from Prajapatis, the Prajapatis came from Brahma, and so on and so forth. So an empirical case can actually be made, so that if you look at the evidence, you see that it makes sense. Now initially this seems perhaps strange to people, but evidence of something new always seems strange when you first hear about it. But the case can nonetheless be made. Actually, many different things that are proposed by modern science also sounded very strange when they first came up. There was a time, well, there are so many different things one could describe there. So this is one example dealing with the origin of life. Also, to take another thing in the Bhagavatam, the idea that there's a soul, this is very basic. Modern science completely denies the concept of a spirit soul that survives the death of the material body. There again, you can show, on the one hand, that science is not able to explain consciousness in terms of the brain. That's a whole subject you could go into. On the other hand, you can show that there's a lot of evidence which backs up the Vedic version, namely that there is a soul. For example, there is empirical evidence for reincarnation, people remembering past lives and so forth. So the basic point then is that you can make a realistic case for the validity of the basic worldview that is presented in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And that involves showing that the worldview being presented in modern science is not completely correct. It's not to say that it's completely wrong, but the important point is that modern science has adopted certain theories, very important theories about the nature of reality, which are in fact incorrect. So ultimately, for Krishna consciousness to be accepted in the world by people in general, especially by educated people, it is necessary for this basic case to be made that the Bhagavatam is actually giving a correct description of reality, and that science in certain respects is giving an incorrect description of reality. As long as people are convinced that science is giving the correct description and the Bhagavatam is wrong, and it's merely presenting old medieval superstitions, then of course they're not going to accept Krishna consciousness. If they do want to turn to something spiritual at all, what they will do is turn to something impersonal. As I was saying in the beginning, the impersonal philosophies are compatible with science, because you can always add an inconceivable Brahman to anything, whatever your viewpoint may be. But when it comes to the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, since Krishna consciousness directly deals with form on every level, and in particular deals with form on the material level, describing the creation, describing the structure of the universe, and so on and so forth. Therefore, in order to make Krishna consciousness actually acceptable to people in general, it is necessary to confront the scientific theories, which are competing explanations of where all these variegated forms came from, what they are, how they work, and so forth. So the main point is that that can be done. Now what time is it, and are we going late, or I don't know what our time situation is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think if we're running late, I can stop just for some questions. This, what I've been saying, as you can see, is an introduction to some further material that I'm going to introduce. But the introduction is important also, because otherwise one would ask, you know, why certain things should be considered. So I'll stop here. Tomorrow I'll say some more also.
Yeah, you have a question?
Yes, actually, as you mentioned, the scientists are presenting a worldview, you know, from their own vision. They're observing certain phenomena in the world, and then they are coming to the conclusion. And Bhagavatam is presenting also the observation and then coming to a conclusion. And the first verse of Srimad Bhagavatam mentions something like the demigods, and even the great sages, they come to wrong conclusions because of the illusory energy of Krishna. The energy itself is so powerful that it even puts into illusion great personalities.
Yes.
So, obviously scientists are also victimized by the illusory energy and everybody else's. So how does the question is that how one comes to the reality? What is there like a one single thing that brings the person out of illusion, or there is a sequence of things, experiences that happens in one's life that one becomes from a non-devoted to come to a devotee platform and himself?
Well, it's a process of development of ideas in a logical order. The question is, how does a person come to be able to say accept the Bhagavatam or understand it to get out of this illusion? Of course, a person may have previous devotional activity and may very quickly become a very advanced devotee. We sometimes see that. A person will come to the temple and suddenly he's very advanced in his devotional activities and understanding. That happens, and that's due to the fact that the person had some previous devotional experience in another lifetime. But for many people, that's not the situation. So the Bhagavatam is giving an explanation in a step-by-step fashion. However, it is giving that explanation in the context of a total worldview which was prevailing in India traditionally over thousands of years, in which people understood quite a number of different things simply on the basis of their education as they grew up. For example, they practically everyone learned about the soul, and they weren't being taught that there is no soul. Of course, there were some philosophers even in India who taught that there is no soul, but they were fairly much in the minority. They weren't so common. So it's a question of education in a step-by-step fashion. So at the present time, what science is doing is providing people with a certain education, which tends to bring them away from Krishna consciousness. So in order to make it easier for people to take to Krishna consciousness, we have to change that educational situation. At least we have to present an alternative which is fully worked out. Right now, you could say that there's an immense chasm, or a huge abyss, if you like, separating the picture of the world that the scientists have from the picture of the world that you have in Krishna consciousness. There's an enormous gap there. So very few people on their own can cross over that gap. A person may get a copy of Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita. He opens it up, sees all kinds of really strange things there, closes it, and that's all. He goes on with his life. He's not able to jump over that huge gap. Well, we can make the gap narrower to make it easier for people. In fact, what we have to do is build bridges with well-paved roads on them, so that you can cross over that gap easily. In fact, we even have to provide bus service across the bridges because the this power of illusion is there, and it's true. It even illusion, it even places the great demigods in illusion. But it's also true that Krishna sends his messengers to the material world in order to enlighten people, to bring them out of that illusion. So on the one hand, Krishna is providing Maya, but he's also providing transcendental knowledge. And ultimately, the individual has to make his choice. But at the same time, one doesn't want to make it too hard for the individual to make that choice. So right now, it's rather difficult for the individual, say in the United States, to choose Krishna consciousness, because it just, for most people, it's incomprehensible. It just looks like some strange mythology. Of course, socially, they're also distanced from it, and that's another whole aspect. So the idea here is to build bridges. And one does this through explanation. And that can be done. One may think initially, well, the Bhagavatam is giving a description of the world that's so much different from the scientific description that you can never bring the two together. But as I'm not trying to make that case here, but I'm just saying that actually you can do that. There are all kinds of things that you can explain